You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week, we bring you the best news, views, and interviews with the CEOs, leaders, clinicians, founders, journalists, politicians, the list goes on, who are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and co-founder of a health tech business myself, which is called PocDoc. Our flagship test, the Healthy Heart Check, gives you a full cholesterol profile, your 10-year risk of heart attack or stroke, and your NHS heart age in just 8 minutes. If you're interested in the Healthy Heart Check, it's available at every single high street pharmacy or directly from PocDoc. That's PocDoc.co. And thank you, as always, to PocDoc for supporting the show. Thank you also, as I say every week, is thank you so much to everyone listening live on UK Health Radio. We love the live platform. Johan and his team do an incredible job, and we're really grateful to be on here. There are so many incredible presenters with fantastic shows. I would recommend that you take a listen. So thank you so much if you're listening live. Thank you also if you're listening on demand on any of the podcast channels. We get downloads now from people in over 50 countries every single month, which is mind-blowing. So thank you to everyone listening across the world. Now we can truly say that the sun never sets on the Health Tech Hour, which is great to be able to say. And thank you, obviously, if you're watching on YouTube on our channel or on Instagram, it's at Steve Roost on my channel where I post the best clips from the show. So thank you, everyone. We love you. Thank you so much for supporting the show. Last week's show with Lord James Bethel was a real eye-opener. So I love James. He's one of my closest friends in the health tech space. And he's just had the most incredible career from founding. He was one of the founders of the Ministry of Sound nightclub in the 90s through to today. He's now one of the leading advocates, and he was directly responsible for pushing the online pornography bill and for pushing around this idea that there are more determinants of health than just clinical data, the external determinants of health. So if that's your bag around how to make the UK healthy again, if that's what you're into, then I would recommend listening to the last episode that we shipped. It was really, really insightful, thoughtful episode. Now, on to today's show. It gives me huge pleasure today to host Dr. Taz Alderwood. Dr. Taz is a GP and the founder of DocAbode, which is a leading NHS digital care product that massively increases NHS capacity in all areas, whether it be on the GP side, in the hospital side, the social care side, and DocAbode and Taz are doing incredible work, very much needed at this point in time where the system is being asked to do more with less, in effect. So I'm really interested to get into the details on that because it's such a highly relevant conversation for the current world that we're living in. Taz is also a pioneer in NHS health, in the NHS telehealth space. and a leading thinker around the future of the NHS. So, Taz, welcome to the show. How are you?
Steve, thank you. What an introduction. Very well, thanks.
I'm a good hype man.
No,
It's what I would love to go on to do with my life.
absolutely. I think the journey and how I got here is probably some of the steps you've taken, Steve, and being a founder, some of
Maybe
the
let's get into it, right? So you're a GP, right? You're a GP? You were a GP, you are a GP. Does one ever leave?
still am a GP. Very much kind of portfolio career, which I decided on quite early on in my career. I think qualified 2004 as a doctor,
Okay.
Leeds Med School, and then started off in more surgical side of things, in neurosurgery. Did a
Wow.
really to be a neurosurgeon. Did my neuroscience BSc as an intercalated degree, one of the first to do that back in the day,
Wow.
and had a great time doing all that, but quite quickly, my entrepreneurial side was like, I want to do business. And so
Okay.
I did an MBA, which was part-time, difficult at the time,
Yeah.
and joined the GP training course in Bradford. And basically, long story short, and then became a fully qualified GP in 2009.
Right.
And I mean, I can take you through all of that, but ultimately started after about 4 or 5 years as a full-time GP in a very deprived area in Bradford. My career took a bit of a crossroads, which I'm more than
Okay.
happy to talk around.
Yeah, let's get into it. So let's just dial it back a second. What
Yeah.
was the system like back in 2004? Like, how was it different, if at
Oh.
all, to today?
I mean, the risks that we took, now having looked back, being whether it was a house officer in Bradford Royal Infirmary or an SHO in Leeds General Infirmary, an A&E.
What's an SHO?
So this is before foundational years. It was house
Okay.
officer, senior house officer. So SHO,
Okay.
senior house officer, and then you'd become a registrar and a consultant if you went down the hospital route. So as part of before I became a GP on the GP training scheme, my first proper job after my house job was neurosurgery, which was I think the first of its kind to kind of take someone so junior into that role. But very much a lot of very few people on the ground. I still remember doing my surgical and medical, house jobs, and the amount of risk that we took on was absolutely phenomenal. There was probably a lot.
Like when you say risk, like what do you can you give
Just
a bit more
very,
color?
probably just not enough people,
Really?
There's not enough people. Very skeleton staff, especially nights, overnights. It was, nowhere near as well staffed as it is today. And I'm not saying it's
Wow.
today, it's still
Yeah.
pretty difficult. But it was, there'd be two of us on a medical, medical specialty with a registrar covering hundreds, if not thousands, of beds, and it'd be
Wow.
crash call after crash call. And A&E was the same. It was,
And
middle of,
was that because it was underfunded at the time, or there was a lack of people literally to get into jobs? Or like, what was the macro then?
Probably a combination of both. I think, in terms of numbers of doctors and things, that has all increased.
Yeah.
I just don't think there was that many of us around. Our med school was around, I think, 100 and maybe 60 to 80 qualified in 2000.
Okay.
Whereas I think most now you're talking 200 to 300 will be qualifying. So I know
Right.
numbers have gone up. And there's a lot of newer specialties that are supporting, we could probably get into this all day, but physicians associates and
Ah.
other staff that are now supporting doctors and nurses in those roles. We had a lot, we didn't have them back in the day.
Right.
That was a very much a, I don't know, a very different world. It felt like a baptism of fire going into
Right.
those roles. You either sink or swim.
Was it scary?
I mean, it was an adrenaline rush.
Okay.
It was, see one, do one, teach one. That was the,
Right.
it was.
Yeah.
If you don't do that chest drain, that patient's going to die, sort of thing. So,
Wow.
and very quickly on the job, and I just don't think it's quite like that now. Now, I'm not saying that was right back then, but you learn very quickly in terms
Right.
of those specialties. And then I joined the GP scheme, went through ENT, ophthalmology, care of the
Yeah.
elderly, psychiatry. You get that privileged role of being a GP trainee. You've got
Yeah.
all these specialties. You do your you're attached to a practice. I ended up being a GP at the practice that I was a registrar at.
Okay.
Absolutely loved that job. And I was very lucky because I was surrounded by very experienced GPs who really taught me the ropes to be a really, I felt a really good GP, solid GP. I was full time in Holmwood in Bradford, which was very challenging.
Okay.
But yeah, when I actually got my MBA, so I was doing my MBA part time. I had a quite a tough choice to make. Do I go down the traditional route, be a GP partner, or do something different? And I decided to do something different at quite a significant salary cost. We offered a kind of full parity partnership role with actually one of my really good mates at med school at the time, who'd had his own practice, versus a 12-month fixed term contract working for it's actually the social enterprise who run the urgent care service in West Yorkshire. And they recognized, Taz likes innovation. So I was offered a role half a day a week to do innovation, 4 days a week, turning around a failing health centre. It was actually the first Darzi centre opened, which was in Bradford. And I was told, if you want your innovation and kind of flexing your MBA muscle, go from sort of book smart to street smart, we'll offer you whatever it was back at the time. And all my friends and family around me said, well, why wouldn't you take this really high paid partner job? And I was like, no, I'm going to take this other role
Did
because
they think you were completely insane?
I was nuts. Because that was a secure job. And I'm like, you know what? Even if it doesn't work out, I could be a GP. I could come back into core general practice at any point. And because I knew I had a sort of entrepreneurial business itch to scratch, so to speak, I was like, I think this will probably be a better experiment,
And where did that itch come from? Is that in your family genes, or is that just inside you?
I mean, funnily enough, I'd say yes and no to the family genes. My grandfather, so my parents are originally from Iraq, and my grandfather was a very successful businessman, and he had date farms and date factories. And my dad used to always tell me about the success he had as a businessman. Parents are both medics, both doctors. They came kind of after, well, mid sort of in the war back in Iraq, Iran.
Oh, they came during the Iraq-Iran conflict.
Yeah, so kind of 1980, 81, I was old. So I came here while they were doing their sort of PhDs and masters and things at the time. I always plan to go back, but we know what happened in Iraq after the next sort of decade or two. But they never ended up going back. So I kind of grew up with parents as doctors, literally going around. My mum's a paediatrician, they're both retired now, and kind of living and visiting my mum in accommodation because they did proper on calls, 48 hours, 72 hours, literally on site. Remember visiting me and my brother would go and visit my mum. But they were very risk averse when it came to business stuff. They are not business minded, but I have always been very entrepreneurial as a very young kid. And yeah, I ended up in medicine despite my parents not wanting me to do medicine, which is a whole other story. Ended up in medicine, but really wanted to get into business and management. And hence, I self-funded my MBA, took the job at Local Care Direct, which is the social enterprise who manage the GP out of hours. And all the time, they manage these five GP contracts. And that changed my whole career, to be honest.
What was it like? What were you actually doing?
So I literally had half a day at the time to kind of do innovation. But the real thing was going into this Darzi Centre, which didn't have any permanent GPs at the time. It had been going for about 5 years. It was in special measures. So the commissioners were like really under the spotlight. This isn't working. And what can we do about it? So my job was to turn around this failing health centre. So straight away I was like, well,
So hold on, I've got a question. Sorry, this is why I love the show. It's just sorry, it just occurred to me. When people say special measures and things are failing, right, which you hear a lot of the time, okay, in the media, they never really explain what that means. What does it mean when something's failing? What does that look like?
I mean, obviously, this was a walk-in centre and a GP practice combined. And there are certain targets and KPIs to meet. For whatever reason, they weren't meeting those targets. And so the commissioners, when there are, it could be lots of complaints from patients, lots of things can start going wrong. And that's where commissioners will then take more of an interest in saying, right, let's scratch beneath the surface here. How many people have you got on? What's your access like? How many appointments are you providing? Why are they failing those specific things? So I came into it probably quite naive. I'm thinking, right, well, it can't be that bad. And it was a lot worse than I thought. And this, I remember going back July 2011 here. That's when I went into this health centre. And I came in as a 30-something-year-old sort of medic, MBA, having to tell 50, 55-year-old GPs what to do. You learn the hard way how to manage people, It's like, who the hell is this coming in saying we're not running things right? So I came in with all these big ideas and how we're going to do it and, getting my MBA, strategy
did you get the PowerPoints out with
and
the charts?
I'm talking ANSOS growth matrix and Porter's five forces. And they're like, we don't, let's do a SWOT analysis. And there's all this sort of stuff. But ultimately, most, culture, the expression culture eats strategy for breakfast. How do you effectively work with people to enable a strategy? And so for me, knowing all the tools that the MBA gives to working with people who they're like, well, who are you and who are you to tell us what we can do differently? So I learned a hell of a lot doing that. And we really turned that place around mainly by getting proper GPs in, bringing a proper team together and making it patient-centric. And so we managed to turn that around. And very quickly, I was given more and more time within that organization to say, right, you've turned around Hillside Bridge. That was the name of the Darzi Centre. Actually, we run four other Darzi centres across Wakefield and other areas in West Yorkshire. Do you want to go in there and have a look and see what you can do? So very I started making my way up the sort of management chain of this organization, which is an amazing organization, who are still going very strong today. And they gave me the opportunity to actually make change happen. And they provide services to the NHS. And so I spent years working my way up in this organization, eventually became a director there. And at the same time, in 2014, that's when CCGs came about. And that's when they said, oh, we need any GPs with any management experience to step forward and be voted by your colleagues to basically lead on a board. And that's when I joined Bradford CCG in 2014. And the same week, I got approached by NHS England saying, do you want to join the national team? This was a crazy time in my life where I then sort of cut down my GP work, which was difficult. Managed to do just enough to feel confident and not kind of let my clinical side slip. But I then was working pretty much a day a week for these organizations for about the next 5 to 6 years.
And how does that what let's so within these Darzi centers, the things that you did obviously worked, but have you got like a couple of examples of things that maybe they were simple cultural things, you know, the some of the things that worked potentially better than you expected, or what were a couple of the things where you were like, oh wow, yeah, that small change made a big difference to patients or to staff?
Best example I'd probably give was a very experienced GP who was probably acting in quite a not particularly clinically safe way. And it was a very challenging conversation because the organization was saying, we've done the audits, we've seen, they're prescribing things that really shouldn't be prescribed and all this sort of stuff. And it was a real difficult one because the culture was set by this GP in this particular practice. So trying to really get them on board using evidence to say, look, if you're not going to change, and we'll offer you everything that we need to do. It was probably one of my first earliest memory of a very difficult conversation to have with someone. I would have really gone in and said, here's the expectation, you're not meeting it. And if we're going to work together to try and improve that situation, this is what we need to do, and we'll help you. But if it doesn't improve, what will then happen? So that was probably one of the first lessons around managing people that I was probably thrown into.
And how did that person react?
Initially, not very well, because I was literally 30, 40 years. They were there, a GP that were, I think at that time, probably in their 70s. And I literally had been a GP for about 5 or 6 years. And
Yeah, I can imagine that was a tough one.
and we're saying, look, from a safety point of view, you're doing this, this, and that. And, can you justify it? Because this was maybe 20 years ago, we'd be prescribing these things, but it's just not what we do now.
That's interesting. Can I just pick up on that, right? Because I well, this is another reason why I love the show is like if something wasn't, how does medicine work in that instance, right? Because things have moved on, things move on all the time. There are new ways of doing things. So how is it that someone is still allowed to do things the old way that isn't the way to do things anymore? Is it quite consensus based in that respect? You sort of have to bring people with you a bit.
I mean, a lot of it at that time is around good quality auditing and outcomes. At the end of the day, if beneath the surface, everything might appear fine, but actually, if you're almost in a bit of a fire and forget situation as a GP, you do something, you might never see that patient again. You don't know whether they've left with a prescription. Do they even cash it in? Do they take that medication? Do they end up in A&E that evening? There's very little feedback that you get unless you're proactive. And we have appraisals and things like that, but they're very sort of light touch. So in terms of actually knowing your outcomes as a GP, it's really difficult to know, are you an effective clinician? And
That's really interesting.
even today, I'm not quite sure if there is a really good feedback mechanism to say, here's, how you perform against others. And you might take twice as long doing a consultation, but actually
Your
that might,
outcomes might be better.
yeah, you might, you could do a consultation in 2 minutes and say, yeah, do you know what? We're going to send you to ED. We're going to call you an ambulance. That's great. I've got a lot of footfall. I'm seeing more people, but the quality of that consultation, it's very easy to say, oh, we've got a GP seeing, 10, 12 people an hour. And we've got someone who's seeing four patients an hour.
Well,
So,
I think this is a really interesting area to come onto, particularly in the light of a lot of what, at least I would say, comes from the center or certainly government is very numbers focused, numbers of appointments, patients seen, waiting lists. It's not very outcome. Well, from what I see as a, Joe Schmo on the street, so to speak. So my producer is sort of screaming at me to go to a commercial break. So we will be right back. In 2 minutes with my amazing guest this week, Dr. Taz Alderwood, who is the CEO and founder of DocAbode and a leading NHS thinker. We'll be right back in 2 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The station that makes you feel good.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello, and welcome back to the second part of today's show with Dr. Taz Alderwood, the inspirational CEO and co-founder or founder of DocAbode. So, Taz, we're going to come back to this issue around NHS targets and outcomes versus inputs and all of these different things. We'll come back to it in a bit later in the show, because I definitely want to get your view on this idea that are we tracking the right thing or the wrong thing? This came up a lot with James Bethel on the previous show. He's not a GP or clinician, so he comes at it from a different angle. But how did you transition from this amazing career in West Yorkshire? What was the inspiration to take that leap from this sort of quasi-entrepreneurial space, like fully into the entrepreneurial space with DocBode?
I guess I was quite lucky because the organizations, especially at Local Care Direct, were almost like as an intrapreneur. So I learned a lot. We set up the telehealth service that you mentioned in your introduction. In a way, I think we're probably a bit too early for that, but I really learned the ins and outs of sort of business as part of that organization. But the main thing was really seeing a glaringly obvious problem that I was like, we need to do something. Something needs to change in how we're managing. And the specific problem was the problem I was embedded in at that time, which was the urgent care system in the GP out of hours world. Mm. And so that, for those that don't know how that works, is when you ring 111. So this is like a non-emergency, you know, that's 999 in ED. You ring 111 and you speak to a non-clinician, but they go through a pathway, NHS pathways, and you're triaged. And that triage will typically say, okay, you need to see or speak to a GP or a healthcare professional. You're then passed to they pass you to a local provider. And that local provider in West Yorkshire is Local Care Direct. And there's these providers, typically most of them, about half of them are social enterprises. Mm. They then will speak to the patient. And then if you can get to one of the centres, walk-in centres, urgent treatment centres, or they'll send you to ED with a GP alongside it. But a lot of the very vulnerable patients, we would send a doctor out in a car to go and see that patient. So these are very frail, vulnerable, typically palliative care patients. And we would determine whether that was a one-hour disposition, so a one-hour target to get there. So that might be someone in extreme pain, palliative care, cancer patient. And then it'd be a two-hour, six-hour. There's lots of different time limits as to how urgent we think that is. And we had the same problem where we just couldn't get enough GPs signing into shifts. And every night in West Yorkshire, you could be talking between 60 and 80 shifts that needed to be filled. Here's when they close.
And do they have to do that? Are they obliged? No, this is totally... Do they get paid extra if they do it or no?
It's basically, most GPs are self-employed. So they will basically, if they want to, they'll do an out-of-hour shift. And this is the crazy thing. So these are services, and there's a lot of overlap with out-of-hospital pathways, which I will probably get to later. So the problem at the time was, there weren't enough GPs signing up to shift. And even those that did sign up, there was some gameplay there. They'd pull out of a shift and they'd want double pay, for example.
Oh, they were trying to play around with that type of gig.
There was some of, again, just a minority who would undermine the system, because those regular people who turn up day in, day out, you'd have people gaming the system a bit.
Mm.
And so you'd have a whole team trying to manage that. And if that relationship broke down, they'd go out to an agency. And that could be anyone paying them a much higher hourly rate.
Yeah.
The whole system was broken. So I picked on one area where, from a patient safety point of view, was unacceptable, where these are people who were doing a home visit and trying to get to them within 1, 2, or 6 hours, we'd end up getting there many, many hours later. And so if that was your loved one, what are you going to do being told, well, there should be someone seeing you in 2 hours, but it's going to be more like 8 to 10 hours? You're either going to call an ambulance or you're going to take them to the hospital yourself.
100%. Or in the worst of instances, if that person has no one, that person's waiting for 8 hours.
That's it. So as a clinician, I was like, this is not the right, you know, these delays are unacceptable. Then there needs to be a new way. And so that's when I kind of pitched my DocBode idea to Local Care Direct, to the CCG, NHS England. I was like, I think there's a new way to re-engage the workforce here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you this backstory because this is how we started, and I'll tell you how we evolved and we had to pivot. So the idea was, rather than picking up a shift, Well, you get paid an hourly rate. The reason I was hearing from my colleagues that would never do a shift in out of hours has I'm knackered. I've just done 12 hours of practice. But if you tell me it's my patient, they're near me, so it's literally 5 minutes away, you know, it's ENT and not gynae, whatever it might be, because they do a lot of subspecialties as GPs. So I was like, okay, so we can match your requirements and the patient's requirements, and you'll just see that one patient. Would that be worthwhile doing? Mm-hmm. I validated that very cheaply and quickly, where all these GPs had never even signed up to a shift said, yeah, I'd consider doing that if the price was right. So the other thing we changed was we would, not us, but the provider would pay them per job.
Right, perfect.
Rather than an hourly rate, it's a, you know, UTI in a care home, urinary tract infection.
Yeah.
You're going to be in and out. In fact, you don't even need a GP. I'll probably come to that later. You know, you're going to be in and out in sort of half an hour.
Yeah.
So let's say you get 50 quid for doing that job.
Right.
And so we proved that quickly, that there was this sort of hidden workforce that wouldn't sign up to a shift, but would do an on-demand way of working.
Kind of like an on-demand / gig type approach to urgent care.
It's almost like gig economy. Some people describe it as sort of love child of Uber meets Match.com. We got the Uber. I never sold us as that. And we were just the software. So we basically, we got to try this out in West Yorkshire.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, look, how can we do this? How can we de-risk it? So we got some grant funding.
Mm-hmm.
That was Local Care Direct supporting me. We tried it out. We got literally, I mean, typically they'd be signing up, you know, a GP once a month into the kind of the West Yorkshire service.
Yeah.
We launched this, and within a week, we had 50 GPs lining
oh,
up.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
So we then trialed it. You know, and the thing is, you still have to have the core service working. And what we did was, anyone who we knew was going to be delayed by the core service was then pinged out to all the GPs who were available, who were nearby. They'd set a radius to say, within 10 minutes of real-time traffic, we'll tell them it's your patient. It's the thing that you said you wanted to see. We wouldn't ping them if it was a thing they felt de-skilled in. They'd see it, and it was literally fastest finger first. Whoever accepted that job would be clinically responsible for going out, seeing the patient. And I remember the very first job that went out. And it was, I still remember, Nigat Sultan, I think it was, who's a GP in Leeds, never had signed up to do a GP out of hours. And I was sat in a control room. I literally said, oh my God, someone's accepted the job. She was care of the elderly, heart failure specialist. The patient was an 86-year-old congestive heart failure patient, and it was her patient. And
oh,
she
wow.
was 10 minutes away. She accepted the job. She turns up at the patient's house. And then the back foot, there was like a number to dial if there's any problems. And then this number came through.
Yeah.
Literally, they said, like, Taz, she wants to speak to you. Like, oh God, something's happened here.
Yeah.
And she went, oh, are you okay if I show the patient why I've turned up? Because they weren't expecting me to.
Okay.
You were told by the service they'd be there in 6 hours, and I've turned up 15 minutes later.
Right.
And I know this patient. And she went, are you okay if I show them? I went, well, yeah, obviously. She did the visit, and she came out and she called again to say, this is amazing. These guys were packing their bags to go to ED because they were breathless. I just titrated their furosemide, which is one of the diuretics that we use for congestive heart failure. I've saved an admission, and I know that because I know the patient, and it was quick. This is brilliant. And from there on, I knew there was a problem that we could solve.
Yeah.
That be beneficial to the system, to the patient. The GPs would earn a bit of extra income.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of partners, because I thought a lot of the locums would want to do this, but the partners did it because they're like, they felt like an obligation to their own patient.
Yeah, it's like you've done absolutely everything. The least that they can do is go and see their own patient. It's like almost like back to the house call days.
That's it. And so we proved it in West Yorkshire. And then we signed our first commercial deal in Manchester and Northwest Coast. And that was in 2019. And then 3 months later, COVID hit.
Yeah.
The home visiting stopped overnight.
Of course.
An SBRI funded public money that spent over £1 million helping us develop this, prove the case, prove the evidence. And the use case died overnight during COVID.
Oh, man. How did you feel?
Well, it was obviously gutting because I was like, I don't have a business. What can I do? But as any good entrepreneur does, if it wasn't COVID related, no one was interested.
True.
So we were like, what can we do to support with COVID? And we were scratching our heads throughout that first wave of the pandemic. And the problem that screamed out at me was around supporting housebound vaccinations for the most,
interesting.
Because the GPs were supposed to do them, but actually logistically it was very difficult because the actual the vaccine had a
cold chain,
all that sort of stuff. And actually we were like, well, we can support with that. And that was our big break, believe it or not. So one of the trusts, I remember one of the associate directors in a North London trust got in contact with us that it was December 2020. Can you help us with the vaccine scheduling? And we went, yeah, let's give it a go. And basically kind of built this thing in midair, launched the vaccine scheduling module of DockerBoad in April 21. And within 3 months, they'd done the dose two vaccines in half the time with half the amount of people. So
cool.
Straight away, they saw the value. And they went, oh, now that you've proven yourself in that, can you turn our attention to these other pathways? And that's where we pivoted our whole product to managing the trust zone sort of staff.
Right.
Bank and agency, should they need that, to manage, because my whole expertise has been in urgent out-of-hospital care.
Yeah.
That's been for the last 15 years. So they wanted us to do things with district nurses, and we said, actually, there's a new pathway, and it's called urgent community response. And that means you have to see someone within 2 hours of being referred to patient, if they're clinically appropriate. How are you managing that logistically right now? And when we looked into it, it was WhatsApp, text messages, paper, Excel,
right,
the diary ledger within the EPR, or they were trying to use a plan scheduling tool for district for plan care.
So the district nurse stuff comes out of hospital, does it? It comes out of the trust community concept.
Yeah, community, I mean, district nursing is more plan care.
Okay.
So like they've got a caseload, they have to see certain patients, and there are tools that manage that really effectively. But we focus on the much higher acuity pathways like urgent community response, discharge to assess, where you need someone there now to try and avoid that hospital admission if
right,
it's avoidable, or support early support to discharge. So the way that's organized is a completely different model of care to how district nurses work. And this was an evolving new pathway that the NHS has doubled down on. So
right,
that 2021, 22, we designed our whole product around these urgent community response pathways. We launched that at this trust at Central Northwest London, NHS Foundation Trust. Great partnership there. They're our first proper early adopter of that solution. And it was like sharing the risk as a true partner, as the NHS sort of saying, well, we'll give you the evidence if this works. And, you know, we'll shout about it. And so very quickly from June 22, we launched there and very quickly did a deal because we doubled their productivity. We saved them money. We improved safety.
Wait, hold on a minute. You doubled their productivity.
We basically doubled their productivity within 3 months.
Wow.
This.
And how does it kind of, what's the nuts and bolts of that sits behind that statement? Obviously, you don't need to explain the actual secret sauce, but conceptually, because productivity is not new. You know what I mean? There's been, I'm sure, lots of very smart people thinking about productivity in every single trust for a really long time. So what was kind of your take on that?
I think there's some sort of fundamental principles around how these pathways work. So typically, you would give, this is how they would work. Now, without DockerBoad, you'd be on a, say, 7.5 hour or 12-hour shift. And they'd say, Steve, we're going to give you 3 hours to account for half an hour of travel either side, and then 2 hours with the patient. So therefore, okay, you got 3 hours on a 7.5 hour slot. You're going to see two patients in that time. The fundamental thing with these urgent pathways, you can have something that's relatively straightforward, like a block catheter, someone fallen over, so there's a fall service, all the way on the other side where it's a very complex frailty assessment and you could genuinely spend 2 hours with the patient. So giving everyone a block of time you've got this sort of glass ceiling of productivity.
Right.
What we do is we say, actually, knowing that this particular patient is a blocked catheter,
yeah,
you're available, Steve. We know where you are. We know that you've got the competencies and skill sets to do that. And in real time, effectively provide data to the coordinators to say, right, Steve's with Taz. He's turned up and actually he's with the patient. We know that. Okay, he's now writing his notes. He's on the phone. Every stage of that. So what then starts as a two-hour block, if there's any time that is released, the coordinator knows straight away
right. what
the real capacity that's. So they then bring in, they're then able to take more referrals and see more patients.
Yeah.
And the frontline staff have protected time, training. We manage all of that for them. And there's a much more equitable sort of distribution of workload. And so that is a way that we gain the trust of the frontline. And we read and write into some of the big electronic patient record systems and some of the national systems. So we know the patient requirement. We know everything about the staff. We know their availability, their proximity to the patient and other staff, their competencies and skill sets. And we do the full care coordination in out-of-hospital pathways to make things run more efficiently and ultimately then require less bank and agency staff. Because right now, to get more capacity in these services, they just need to hire, and they can't recruit and retain. It's very difficult at the moment,
yeah.
and it has been for quite a while. So actually, rather than keep throwing kind of wood on an open fire, it's a, well, how do we get more patients seen, going from, on average, 2 to 3 visits in an average shift? We typically turn that to roughly between 5+, so
right.
5 and 8 visits. And that's purely from using the current workforce you have in a smarter way.
Well, on that note, we're going to go for our final commercial break and we'll pick up that thread when we come back. So this is the final break in today's show with my guest today, Dr. Taz Aldaboud, who is the CEO and founder of Docabode, which is massively increasing the productivity of the NHS workforce, as we've just heard. So we'll be back in 2 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date, and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello, and welcome back to the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Dr. Taz Aldaboud. So Taz, that all sounds absolutely phenomenal. But I'm sure it's not as easy as you made it sound. So without wishing to get into the full, you know, all the issues, because I'm sure if people listen, and I think this must happen, if I take myself out of my PocDoc space, there seems to be, if I was a normal person listening and we were a really broad church of people listening, there are so many things out there that seem to be able to solve every single problem the NHS has. It doesn't matter what area you look at, radiology, you know, right the way through to workforce, to screening, et cetera, et cetera. So with something like this, like what, I'm sure it's not been smooth sailing. So what have been some of the bumps in the road or like challenges with that? Again, let's not make it too negative, but I do think it's interesting because if I was listening and I wasn't in the industry, I would be thinking, well, hold up a second, why isn't that everywhere? But I'm sure there's potentially some good reasons. I don't know. Over to you.
Well, I think it's knowing, obviously, if you think the NHS is one organisation, obviously it's not.
No.
And it's sort of knowing who your customer is as a sort of health tech and digital solution. Yeah, there's challenges along the way. You know, how do you gather the evidence to prove it's actually going to do what it says? And in a real world setting. So you need to have those organizations and really individuals, you know, it's people who really make the decision in the end of the day that are willing to really, you know, take something forward with risk and how to share that risk. So you've got this sort of public-private partnership that needs to happen because no one likes to go first. And the thing is, that's what kills most startups. It's that time period of, right, now we've got something. It's not a solution looking for a problem. This has been co-designed from the beginning to fit into a pathway that seamlessly integrates into the workflow, because clinicians don't care about your tech. They want, we want to spend more time in direct clinical care doing what we do best. We want less clicks. We want things that just work. The technology shouldn't even be talked about. It should just be part of the everyday.
It's just business as usual, right?
BAU. And we, if success for us is, it's in the background doing what it does.
Yep.
But a lot of tech get introduced as sort of, right, we're piloting this. Okay. And the threshold to get that business case over the line is a very unfair threshold, because the status quo of, yeah, we need more money for more people gets approved day in, day out in the NHS.
I think that's a really interesting insight that I want to pick up on, right? Because, and this is why I love having people like you on the show. And actually, I didn't mention this, but Taz and I are both lucky enough to be on the same NHS innovation sort of fellowship concept. And I think what Taz said there might have slipped by. So I want to really pick up on it, which is that there's this idea of the cost of change, but there's no idea really of the cost of not changing. So what often happens to innovators like us, and I mean pretty much anyone, right, doing anything, is that you're confronted with having to prove or argue against the cost of any change, but there's never an appreciation of the cost of not changing something. Is that kind of a fair expression of what you were trying to get to?
Yeah, because I guess the NHS is very good at managing the risk of how things are currently working. And there's almost an acceptance to say, yes, we're not meeting these targets. Yes, there are delays. Yes, there's clinical risk. Okay, so what do we do about it? Well, we know this way of working, and to solve it, throw money at something, hire more people to still work in the same way we've always worked. And that is the risk that the NHS carries every day. So it's easier to make a case to commissioners to say, right, well, if you want us to see more patients, you want us to improve, well, give us more money. But we know that, you know, putting more money to try and hire more staff to work in the same way with the tools that they've got, which can be not the right tools that are built for this day and age, to be, you know, not too disparaging of what's already out there. The NHS staff are very good. We've been brilliant at, we will work with whatever we're given. And we won't.
They literally do work with whatever they're given, basically.
And we'll overlay systems and they'll go, right, well, we've got this system, but it can't do that. So we'll build an Excel to do that. And they build all these manual processes. And when you take a hard look at that, and we love our process mapping, how are you currently doing things? Take an honest look of the as-is model. We then send our business analysts in and we go, right, genuinely, you've told us you just get a referral in this way, it lands in your system. And I remember doing this with a trust in North London. And I went, can we just stop? You had like 20, 30 people in the room. And, you know, you could feel a sense of resistance because someone's whole job was managing this really manual process.
Yeah.
We always bring our customer. We always bring one or two of our customers in. And we say, do you know that process that you put as one line in your process? Can you run me through exactly how that happens? Okay, well, we get an email, but it arrives in a JPEG format. So we print it, we scan it as a PDF. We do, and I'm not even kidding, there's like a dozen processes. And you're like, that's the inefficiency we talk. And then they went through the rest of it and our customer piped up because it was all drawn out with the trust business analyst. And then he just went, that's one click in Dockerbode. And we said, how long does it take you to do all this? This is all kind of how you currently do things.
Yeah.
Like, that's 20 minutes of process and it's one click in Dockerbode. Never mind the rest of it. And you could just see their jaws dropping and going, right, now we're going to take this seriously.
Right.
Then you've got a challenge of, okay, so we're saving money from a coordination point of view. We're saving money on your agency spend, your bank staff. But you're saying there might not be a budget. Well, let's look on NHS jobs and look at all the unfilled jobs that you're now using that budget to spend on agency and bank staff. So what if we did things differently? Because I don't buy that there is no money. There is billions that are spending.
Yeah, I'm with you. So I've always, I don't come from a healthcare background prior to doing PocDoc, but I never, ever understood why people would say that there's no money. There's loads of money. They're just not spending it on this or that, or they're making choices about how to spend it. So it's definitely the NHS spends 130 billion a year. I mean, a lot of that's on workforce, to be fair, but that's actually, that kind of ties in with your area, less so on our area. But yeah, it's just not true to say there's no money. It's just that they're choosing to spend it in what some might believe to be less efficient ways.
And that's the challenge. I mean, it's trying to get a business case approved with a finance director that's holding a higher threshold, to be frank, for a digital or a medtech solution and comparing it to the risk and inefficiency of the current way of working. Because no one ever gets fired for doing what they've already done.
Nope.
And that's why the challenge of saying, can we spend this money differently? You're talking about whether it's a CIO, a director of finance, you know, these are all the people that have to actually say, we're going to do things differently. We're just the enabler. You know, most of this for us is buying into proper service redesign. You know, we're just the enabler. We're just the thing in the background that will help you achieve more efficiency and productivity, safer working. And if you're proven to prove outcomes for patients, improving the working lives and well-being of staff, improving productivity and efficiency, you can prove that you're slotting seamlessly into a pathway and workflow. You've got the evidence for an in-year ROI. You've got real-world impact evaluation. We've got this. We're on the NIA. To get on the NIA, you've got to prove all these things. But is that a guarantee that you're in with one trust and the next trust want to do a pilot? Why would you want to do that and take us back to square one? This is, you know, we're talking evidence-based evaluations that have proven the effectiveness of our solution.
So interesting. So this is really interesting. I get, and some people don't like it when I say stuff like this, but I mean, I'll say what I want to say. But so my background was all around commercial sales, venture capital backed businesses, enterprise sales. So the idea that I completely understand what you're saying, and I think in an ideal world, that would be true. But similarly, neither do I think it's unreasonable in a way that you've got, if you take ICBs for, well, trusts, how many trusts are there? 100 something? How was it? 150 roughly?
Yeah. I mean, there's a queue.
I mean, it's a little bit. That's
about 200 odd, but yeah.
Okay. Cause like, that's 200 customers. And so if they weren't all bundled up under the NHS, right? Let's say we went to Germany and those 200 customers, there's about 200 public insurers in Germany. So I wouldn't expect a public insurer in Germany to just take on whatever its fellow did, if that was a separate organization, you know? So, but I do completely agree that we should be trying to trend towards removing blocks out of the system.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a, how do you de-risk it? How do you know? Yeah. Most of the time, if it's a pilot, just to kind of go, you know, is this going to work for us? A lot of that is in the kind of pre-sales bit of saying, this is how it's worked in another service. We always encourage them to go and look at a real world site visit. So you're not hearing any sales patter. It's speak to NHS colleagues who've done the hard yards of it.
That's absolutely critical.
That is gold dust, because then they'll want to know warts and all how difficult it was to persuade the one person who didn't want to change, for example. How did they go about that? How did you do this with your IT and digital teams? How did you get the business case through? Procurement, all that stuff. So I think the NHS needs to be better at helping each other, and that's the key thing.
I completely agree with that statement, where like you're all part of this overall organization, but there's sometimes very little communication between these entities about what works and what doesn't work, even before you get to the, well, I worked with you, so I should get green lit with this other one. Just basic sharing of what works and doesn't, I think, is a major opportunity for the system.
Yeah, and to be fair, we were quite lucky because the system we were operating in North London, the commissioners there in NCL, North Central London, we worked with some amazing people. Chris Garner, Shafiq Tijani, Jason Boston, a lot of people, a lot of names have really supported this from the start to realise, hang on, they're getting a pull from the trusts in their ICB to say, well, we've seen this working in CNWL. We've been, you know, this is something we want. And it's the ICB then led that sort of, well, if you all want this, how are we going to do this as a system? So we've got trusted assessor models. We're not doing a clinical safety case every single second.
Yeah.
It's kind of doing things once approach and not just a bucket of cash, a much longer term deal. And
yeah.
That ultimately gave us the headroom to look at a much more strategic outlook. Then they were saying, and then that's how it spread. We work with the regional team, and you need that level of engagement so that the trusts are even aware that this exists. A lot of the time, they're so head down, just trying to deliver, keep the lights on, so to speak, that they don't have an awareness of what is being done differently in a neighboring organization, and it's being done very well. And if there are challenges that you're going to work through with them. And I think as entrepreneurs, we've got to recognize that there isn't a one size fits all either.
No,
got
I
to
agree.
Work with the system.
And yeah, yeah. You know, when I talk to people, I know you talk to people and things like that. You know, whenever I look at LinkedIn and some of the comments that I see, and it's sort of, it's almost like this finger pointing around wanting to the NHS to be this way or that way. And at the end of the day, as an entrepreneur, you have to go with what you got. You know, you have to work. You have very little opportunity or capability to change your customer, like to change the way that they behave. And so you have to kind of work a way to work with that. So we're coming to the end of the show, and I ask everyone that comes on this question, which is, there's obviously been tough times through your career, whether or not it was when you were at the beginning and you were like the only person on night shift, or when you started the company, or when COVID happened or whatever, and you kind of almost lost it. What is the one motto or one kind of phrase that you keep returning to that's kind of gotten you through some of those tough times that you would want to share with the world?
I think having people around you that believe in you, and having that trust that, you know, Taz is someone who is very determined, who can really understand the problem, and having those support from family, friends, that very early support to know that this is going to take time. It's going to take time, and you need people around you that are going to see you through that thick and thin, because it is very stressful. You'll know this as a founder.
Oh, yeah.
Stressful. It takes much longer than you think. It costs way more than you have. The personal sacrifice that people don't see until you start becoming successful, they haven't seen the last 10 years to get to the point that we're at, you know, and, you know, we've managed to get into that scaling position. It is very, very difficult. So, you know, it's a very lonely place as a founder and as a CEO. So to have the right advisors, the right mentors, the right family and friends around you to say, we're going to keep supporting you through the kind of roller coaster ride, you know, that is gold dust. And if you've got that, that is what I've lent on, you know, to have that sort of determination, the tenacity to keep going.
Brilliant. Well, look, on that note, thank you very much, Dr. Taz Alderwood from Dockerbode. What's the web address if people want to find out more about Dockerbode?
Dockerbode.com.
There you go, Dockerbode.com. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week.
Thanks, Dave.